Welcome to Combox. I am Jared Kimber. This is Robbie, and this is the Kim Apa Show, where the two of us sit in vastly different locations. He's in the sweaty armpit that is Durban, and I'm in the cold as hell hellhole that is the UK. How's the SA20 been treating you, brother? How's the travels? You enjoying it?
Yeah, I love
how much meat. No, actually, fuck that. That's what you would say on a normal podcast. What you say on this podcast is how much meat have you had, and is the meat starting to sweat out of your eyeballs yet?
Not yet. But I've been belting meat. Like, it has been phenomenal, dude. I love this tournament. I love this country. The tournament, bro. It was a Monday yesterday, right? At Pretoria, at Centurion. It was a Monday. It was a packed house, bro. Granted, it's holiday season still. Kids haven't gone back to school. Yeah. But, brother, every single game, when I say every single game, I mean every single game, there are people out with their picnic bags, their picnic carpets, their picnic mats. And it is just such a cool vibe, bro. It is like, it's the place where you want to raise kids, right? It's like, you know, given everything else that's ailing this country, but the atmosphere, how sporty it is. Kids are here, like families are here at the ground. If the match starts at 5:30, families are there at the ground by about 2 o'clock. And they're allowed to play inside the field, right? Till at about 4 o'clock. So families come early just to kind of get the kids to experience what it feels like to play inside the ground. Obviously, the pitch and the square and all that's protected, and they get to play one side of the ground. And they actually play and they have fun. And the kids are just playing all through, man. It's such a community feel. It's so great. Like, I love this tournament. The vibe itself is like, it's like a festival every game. Every game's like an event, right? And they come in the numbers, young and old, granddads with grandkids, grandparents with grandkids, mums and dads. And just, it's so much fun. And they have this whole, what is it called? I think it's a, you take a catch in the crowd with one hand without fumbling, and you get to be a part of the 2 million bounty that's there. I think so far about 8 people have taken a catch. Bro, one catch is better than the other, man. It is so much fun. It's something that fans have to look forward to like a lot. I love it.
Can I give you a challenge for the SA20?
Go.
All right. The next game you go to, I want you to go around and sample food from like 4 or 5 of the braais that are inside the ground. And I want you to like do a social video to say which is the best braai that you've had from each place. Because like I did that years ago, like before social media was a big thing. Like I would go around to the grounds in South Africa and just go up to random people who were cooking and go, can I just have some? Like I'll pay you if you want, but I just want to try what you're cooking. And the food's incredible, man. And I love
the
that.
Food's so good.
The kind of like you're watching the smoke like come up from the braai while the game's on.
Like at the Centurion, that's what happened. Like they have a kitchen there, I think it used to be a small cottage, but now they made it into like a canteen or some sort, like a tuck shop, so to speak. So, and then they're cooking braai there, right? And then you can see there's a whole waft of smoke like going across the ground. And that is just braai, right? And man, it's so cool because you like imagine a batter like there batting and he hadn't had a meal, and you just get the waft of that food coming through you all the time. It's phenomenal, dude.
Have you ever heard the Daryl Cullinan story when he hit the ball into the ground? And I think it was someone's braai, but it was certainly someone cooking on the side of the ground, as they do. Even the food stalls cook on the side of the ground in South Africa. And he hit the ball into a tray of calamari. And it like all the grease ruined the ball and they had to get a new ball because of the calamari. It's just, that's not happening at another cricket ground. It would be impossible for you to hit to like where someone was cooking almost any other grounds. But in South Africa, that's such a normal thing. It's just, it is such, and you're right, the smells, you are constantly, I remember in the old days, dude, the food in South African press boxes was like the worst boarding school cardboard food of all time. And all you could smell is like the best braai all around you.
Yeah, I know. I second that.
Have you followed any of the Ashes? It's not a particularly good time zone for you. Right?
No, it's not. But a lot of us are staying up at night watching the Ashes till like 3 o'clock in the morning and then going to sleep. Luckily for us, there's some evening games which start at 5:30 in the evening, so we can afford to do that. And it's been wow, man! And that Sydney Test match has been something, eh? A lot of talk about certain players, certain decisions. I think for me, what's come to the fore is the way Steve Smith. Forget his batting, Lesson. I think he's a savant when it comes to batting, but when it comes to his captaincy, he's been quite underrated. And I think his his, I know the focus is all front and center Pat Cummins, but the way he's led in the few test matches that he has in this series has been really, really good.
No doubt. It's actually, there's one thing I want to talk to you about captaincy in that series is, someone asked me this question recently about why players don't, like, if you know they're going to go to the bouncer theory, why players don't duck more when it comes to the bouncer theory. And some of the reasons are technical, right? Because if you start to duck, they bowl around the wicket to you and it's harder to duck when they're coming around at you and your bat gets, and your gloves get in the way and everything else. It's also, once you start to automatically think of ducking, you're not always in the best position to play a ball if they do a surprise full one and everything else. Yeah. But it is, when you watch Jamie Smith and Travis Head in this, like at both times, it looked like they were trying to get out rather than just wait the 5 minutes before the bouncers were going to finish. Like, it's a really interesting one now that team, like, Jamie, what was Jamie Smith trying? What shot was he trying to play? Because even if he middles that, there's a chance he's not going to hit it over deep cover for six.
And right? the longest
and Travis
boundaries.
Head kept trying to hit the ball to everyone.
Yeah. No, but Travis, at least you saw him play that shot as often as he could post his 100, right? Like, I think till his 100, he was fine. But post his 100.
No. It was after 100. But at the same time, like, do you remember in the old days, people won't remember this because everyone now is like, oh, you know, modern players throw their wickets away. But in the old days, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, there were heaps of guys who would make 100 and then just play the three worst shots you've ever seen straight after they'd made 100, right?
Yeah.
As in job done, tick. And you're like, you'd see, you know, this. Mark Waugh was the famous for this. Like, he'd make 100 and then he'd get bored and he'd just start slogging after 100. Travis Head did that. And I was like, he wants a break. He thinks his job is done here. He's off.
He was tired. Right? Like, he alluded to that. He said he was tired after 100 at T, and so he probably wanted to score as many runs as possible. You heard the point where they asked him in the press conference, you've gotten out between 150 and 175, like 15, 16, whatever times. And he turns around and says, that's a shit stat, isn't it? So it was funny, but I think he
played
really
well. But there is a, like, it's a shit stat. But it's also a stat that tells you a lot about Travis Head because he does get tired.
Yeah, he does.
Right? Like,
tired,
he does get to a point. Like, my favorite moment in any Travis Head thing now is when he starts to walk between the wickets. Because he starts off like running, then he goes to jogging, and then he becomes Arjuna Ranatunga, right? And he's just like,
he reminds me of David Boone for some reason, dude. Like,
he's got a mustache and a belly. He's got a mustache and a belly. He has a bat like David Boone.
But just chilled out. You know what I mean? Like, his demeanor is like really chilled out. He feels like he understands his game. And he just...
Okay. I'll give you this. This is what I think is that if you look at David Boone and you look at Travis Head, they are very comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They are who they are. Because if you go back, David Boone comes on the scene at the same time that Steve Waugh and Dean Jones do, right?
Yeah.
Steve Waugh... always conscious of his batting average, right? Always conscious of where he's going to end up in the legacy. Dean Jones, style icon. We talked about him the other one. The guy that puts sunglasses on cricketers, right? You know, talks about fashion, not fashion, but looking good on the field in his books, like early on in his career. It's in his books, dude, right? And then you've got David Boone, who is like, it doesn't matter, mate. I'm just going to make runs.
Yeah.
Right? And there's an element of that with Travis Head. And the interesting thing is that style has become much more a thing, right? Like, you've got this whole social media era and Travis Head goes on this podcast. He hasn't shaved, right?
Yeah.
He hasn't dressed up for the podcast. I won't say this, but there was a famous player who I did something with who wouldn't let me put the video out because they hadn't had a shave before the podcast. And I was like, dude, you look great. Like, and he's like, no, I don't do video stuff with stubble, right? Wow. Like, he was so clear in his mind of how he wanted to look on camera, and all power to him. Can either of us imagine Travis Head, you know, messaging me the next day and go, can't put the video up, mate. I saw there was a stain on my t-shirt. He wouldn't even notice.
Yeah, he wouldn't. He wouldn't. He's really comfortable in his own skin. And you can see, like he owns every part of him, right? You can see it even the way he bats, like, so clear. Like, it's almost like he's invented his own style of batting. Like, I think, and it's actually having an impact on the overall game of Test cricket. Like, I would say Baz ball has done its time, and it's more like what? Trav ball or head ball or whatever. Head ball.
or punt ball, right? Like, it's those sort of guys. And there's a really interesting thing when it comes to, Travis Head. He was speaking about this recently, and Harry Brook does it and Rishabh Pant does it, where he said, basically what I do is I look at the field, and I try and exploit the field every time, right? Yeah. And that is a very new way of batting. Viv Richards obviously did it. Victor Trumper obviously did it. KP obviously did it. I'm not saying that these guys have invented it, but that whole movement has happened now. And you see, I don't think Travis Head does it as much as Harry Brook or Rishabh Pant, but both of those guys do what we would call in our day ball counting, where yeah. it's like, dot, dot, oh, I need to hit a boundary now. Where's the best place to hit a boundary? I'm going to do this. And that's why they're in some of those ridiculous positions. And
Surikumar Yadav does that in T20 cricket. Oh, he was doing that when he was scoring runs. Like when wherever the fielder is in, he tries and hits a boundary in that direction.
Exactly. And that wasn't how we were taught, right? We were taught exploit the field, but treat each ball on its merits. And these guys aren't treating each ball on its merits. No. And you look at Travis Head and the ability he has to just be like, oh, okay, they've got this field now, so I'm just going to walk out to this position and play this shot with no fear, right? Yeah. With no panic or anything. There's a point again when Potts had three guys on the offside boundary, which on its own is just a crazy amount of people to have on the offside boundary. Yeah. That's Brian Lara numbers. That's Brian Lara and he's 150 not out numbers, right? Yeah. He's got three guys on the offside boundary and he walks outside the off stump and tries to flick the ball on the leg side. But it's not like a big shot like Brook or Pant would play. He's just like, well, what else am I going to do? And that's how he does all of his batting. And it's a really fascinating thing to watch.
Yeah, it is. I think his batting and the way he's batting is, as we speak, revolutionizing the way I think, and bringing a modicum of balance with the whole baseball and then that whole craziness bit, right? I think he's found a middle ground where he knows how he's going to attack and still play at almost a runner ball. He's not trying to score 100 of 60 balls every game. Like he's trying to play, he is allowing the wicket to dictate the shots he's going to play. And he's playing based on the wickets. He knew and recognized that Sydney is going to be a much better track than a lot of the other tracks that they've played on. And he capitalized on it with the shot selection that he had, which is what I think was what stood out for me. And England, literally, they've been bowling like they've been batting, right? Like it's been all over the shop, right? It's been so inconsistent. Like you see the economy rate of each of the bowlers, it's like they don't have a fixed plan. And I think that is with intention to not have a fixed plan. Like I think they've been open-ended like they have been with their batting. And it's just been unfortunate to see because it puts England cricket in bad light.
I disagree with you, they don't have a plan. Clearly their plan is that the stumps are overrated and you should never, ever bowl at them again. I mean,
but tell me
did
something.
Did you see the TV graphic? I think George Nobel tweeted it. And it looks like a fucking afro around the stumps.
Yeah.
Right? Like it looks like they did everything they could not to bowl at the stumps.
Like, how do you do that? And the only time they got wickets is when they hit that corridor.
Oh, so Matthew Potts, right? So I've been saying all series he should play, right? Because he's their one accurate bowler. Not in world best form, but if you go back to how he was bowling in the warm-up games, he's been going at about 2.5, 3 runs and over, getting his wickets. Fine. I don't think they thought he was in great wicket-taking form, so I understand why, but they thought he was in good rhythm and good form. He comes in, his second spell, would be his third spell, but his first spell on day three, whatever it was yesterday. He comes in. Yeah.
You don't remember, do you? Today was
day three yesterday. Wasn't it?
Yeah, yesterday. Okay, you've slept. Okay, cool. Got it.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
I have no idea. How have you kept track, bro? Like, because you've not slept. This whole Ashes series. Dude. Like, guys, it's been so hard to get hold of him. Like, I think the only time we can get hold of Jar is when the Ashes are going on. The Ashes, and he's been fucking grumpy, right? He's been...
grumpier than usual.
And we've had to kind of tiptoe around him, especially when talking about Combox, like... brother, like we try and kind of inject it with humor to hope to get a response from him. It's like we're barely getting any responses from him either. We're like, so we can't wait for the Ashes to get over because we get normal Jared back then.
I don't know, there is a normal Jared. If you want to hear grumpy, listen to this. So Potts comes in. He hasn't bowled particularly well. He got smashed in at the start of the innings. He's now bowling his first spell on the new day. And his first ball is a wide floaty full ball to Travis Head, who's already set, right? He smashes it through the covers. And I'm like, okay, everyone gets a loosener, Robbie. Like, I'm not going to pile into him or anything. And then his next ball is short and wide outside of off stump. And I'm like, so what has happened here? Can he not this is their most accurate bowler in this test match. Has he lost the skill to be accurate? Right. Then the next ball he bowls is the, you know, when you can tell a bowler stops short in their action and they're just pushing the ball down. So like trying to get the ball down there. And of course, Travis Head just smashes it. I was like, he doesn't feel comfortable running through. Clearly the plan is to bowl wide and he doesn't feel comfortable with that because it's not what he normally does. Why is he bowling short anyway? And you just look at it going, you had one like adult bowler that you took on the entire tour with him and you're still stuffing him up. Right. And everyone's like, well, he hasn't bowled in ages, whatever. I'm like, motherfuckers, he bowled the day before. Yeah. Like, he bowled 10 overs or 8 overs or whatever it was the day before. This was worse on the second day. And he didn't bowl enough to get sore. Right. And he's not fast bowler. Like, he's what, 137, 138? Like, he's basically Scott Boland pace. And he's spraying it around everywhere. And then, as you said before, is the plan an absence of plan? Like, what is the thought process with England at this point? What are they trying to get Matt Potts to do? Because I've seen him bowl for Surrey, for Durham. I've seen him bowl for England. I've never seen him do this before. Like, it's like these bowlers come in and they just like mess them up so much that they have no idea what to do. Cass came on the other day and he's like, his first spell, he bowled two full tosses. Two full tosses. I know. The test match.
Yeah.
Australia is literally hitting the ball on a length for five test matches. And England are like, do you know what? We've heard about this length thing and we don't think it's for us.
We don't buy it. We don't buy it at all.
We're going to bowl really full or really short. And just everything else is in. And it's like, and at the same time, Scott Boland's like, guys, do you know what I'm going to do again? I'm going to bowl the same ball I've been bowling every single time.
They've been like, it's just been like chalk and cheese, right? It's like, it actually grates you to watch a team with a degree of potential, you know, where they can make this cricket really exciting, playing the way they're playing right now. I can't imagine what the England fans must be feeling like. Like at least the not the postmodern fans, but at least the, you know, the modern fans. Like, what are they thinking about the way they're playing? And what's going to happen after this series? Yeah, they'll go back 4-1 or 3-2 or whatever it'll be. Unless something super drastic happens at Sydney. Yeah. I don't see this becoming 3-2. I think it, for all intents and purposes, looks a lot more like 3-1. Depends on how England decide to bat in the second innings.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. It's 3-1 or 4-1, isn't it? If you were betting from here, those are the two options that you would go with.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, I had that written down as a question for you because I don't know what they do, right? They go back. It doesn't really matter if it's 3-2 or 4-1 now because it's quite clear that everything they're doing is wrong. Right. Yeah. Let's be honest. Let's not even get on their fielding. They've dropped
four catches in this innings.
They've taken 42 catches in the series and they've dropped 12. Right. And Australia has taken 60 catches in the series and dropped 7. And that's very kind. That's the CricViz where they're like, oh, I'm not sure that's a chance type number.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that comes from CricViz, but it's someone like that. If that's me, I'm like, they've dropped 25 catches, guys. What are we talking about here, right? But
this is the grumpy, okay, grumpy Jared.
Yeah. You've got, you know, but that, did you see the Will Jacks drop?
Oh my God, bro. Like,
well, okay, that drop, okay. Like, I want to ask you as a professional cricketer, the Jamie Smith wicket to Manus Abhishek or the Will Jacks drop, which was the one that actually pisses you off more?
Oh, I'll have to say the Jamie Smith one. Because it's just before lunch, right? You've got five other fast bowlers in your ranks and you've bowled Manus Labuschagne. And then you've got like barely any time for lunch. So clearly, you know, they have, like, Steve Smith has done this to literally taunt England, right?
Yeah.
They've done it to say, you know what? Here, let's see what you do with this. You know,
so I would play devil's advocate to that theory, which is you know he's only going to bowl one or two overs, right? And if you and you want to whack him for some fours, hoping that the fast bowlers might have to come back.
And he's a grating personality as well for the opposition, by the way. Marcus is.
So I kind of get that. But the execution of what James, as I said before, I don't know where Jamie Smith was trying to hit the ball, other than the fact he was trying to hit it hard. And once he realizes the ball's not in the right area, he just has to bail out of that
shot. Bail from the shot.
But the Will Jackson is like, he takes his eye off the ball when you do not need to take your eye off the ball. If you take the catch and your foot's on the rope, don't get me wrong, it's wrong. But why do it at that stage? You either have to look early or you look after the ball's hit your hands. Right?
Yeah.
It's such a basic fundamental error for a guy who makes his money playing white ball cricket, Robbie. Yeah, right? Yeah, he makes his money playing white ball. So there's a part of me that's like, the Jamie Smith thing is worse, but what Will Jacks did is like, it just looks like their heads are not in the game at all.
It's a testimony of literally England's mindset, right? Like where they are, they're just nowhere. Like it's like, it's just ad hoc, right? Like it's like whatever flies, right? There's not a care about what the outcome is going to be like. They're just hoping that the outcome goes their way. That's what it feels like from the outside. And they're just going to say, this is our style of cricket. Take it or leave it. If you don't like it, fuck you. If you like it, great. You know, and that's how, literally that's how they're playing cricket. And like, man, that is very basic, right? That is elementary, to be honest, that drop was. But in the context of the game, Jamie Smith was had more of an impact in the game because they were 323 for 6.
It probably did because I think Head was already heaps of runs by that stage in Australia. Yeah.
He was already at post 100, I think that was when that happened.
Yeah, and also the ball was still seeming around though, so there is an element of if they got new players in at that stage, they had about 15 overs where it seemed around. Because remember when Steve Smith came in, he wasn't batting fluently. Like, he was struggling a little bit. So there was something going on in the surface. And then after that, the ball got a bit soft. And so, I think when once Smith was batting with, who was Smith batting with? Head himself, right, at that point. But that period before the second new ball, they should have probably taken extra wickets. But that also is because they don't bowl in the right length over and over again.
I stopped listening to you from the point you said the ball's gotten a little soft. And in my head, I was like, that's what she said. I was laughing. And then you said head.
The ball got soft after head. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Like Combox. The ball got soft after head. That's our new line. Can we talk about the one genius thing of English cricket, which of course is Joe Root and this innings, which I thought was masterful. But he did this thing after the innings where he came and talked to Justin Langer. And my big frustration with players when they talk to players is they very rarely ask them the questions that players should be asking players. They end up still doing what the press does, right? Which is the banal. How did it feel out there? Shut up. He's tired. That's how it feels. It always feels tired, right? It always feels good, bad, or tired. Those are the only three options when you ever ask that question. But he asked something better. He sort of said, what would you tell a young batter based on what you did in that innings, right? And I want to go through this. I know you've seen the video because I sent it through to you as well.
Mm.
Right. The first thing that Joe Root mentions, well, he actually talks about watching the ball and the ability to keep watching the ball over a long period of time. And then he realizes, actually, what I need to tell them is something more specific here. And he says,
can we break this down? Like, because whatever he said in 1 minute can be extrapolated and broken down. Because I've been saying it and then the comment section goes like, this fellow's talking shit, right? But can we, like, since he said it, can we break it down? Because there's so much that can be extrapolated from that 1 minute of a video. Like, let's take the first two sentences.
Do you want to start with the watching the ball bit?
Yeah, watching the ball bit for long periods of time. Like, what does someone like Stephen Smith or any test batter mean by that, right? The ability to watch the ball over a long period of time means the ability to build the endurance mentally and emotionally to be able to switch on and switch off over a long period of time to focus on the most basic things that is required to play a ball well, right? So you play a ball and so when you prepare to play a ball before the first ball, you want to say the right things to yourself to switch on, right? You got to teach yourself the ability to switch on before a ball to watch, to do the most important things with batting, right? And the one of those, maybe there are two elements to it. The first element is to watch the ball, right? And to watch the ball and to fierce focus in. So as the bowler is running in, there's soft focus. As he gets closer to the wicket, there's fierce focus on just the ball, how the bowler is holding, what the seam position is like. Today doesn't count very much because there's the wobble seam comes into play almost every ball.
But you're still looking to see if that's setting up.
You're still looking to capture as much information as possible, right? And then once you've played the ball, to switch off immediately, to detach from the result of that ball, and let your mind relax completely for a period of 10 to 20, 30 seconds, and then switch back on to soft focus as the bowler starts running in, and then
do you
move that into fierce focus as you're getting close to the umpire.
Yeah.
That is
so
what...
marathon runners have like mantras that they say. Do batters have like little code
words, trigger words.
Yeah.
Trigger points, trigger words that we have. Like for me, it was always in present tense, present in continuous tense. For me, it was like, I'm watching the ball from the journey, I'm watching the full journey of the ball from the bowler's hand till after I played, right? That was my mantra. So I'm watching the ball. I'm watching the ball right now.
So what I thought was interesting about the root comment is that I think once you get in, I think if you're a shit batter, so this doesn't, you know, you won't understand this as much, but you will know the sort of players I'm talking about. I think once you face about 20 or 30 balls, I realize I'm not really watching the ball anymore, right? Now, some of this is subconscious. Right.
Good.
Because once your subconscious takes over, it's fine. But also, I every year, Robbie, I make a huge score in the first or second game. Right. And by the end of the year, I'm in a slump. And it's because the first game, I'm so nervous that I'm watching the ball really closely, even when I'm making runs. And once I make those runs, I'm like, I'm doing fine now. So the next game, I'm watching it that little bit less. Right.
Lesser,
and I can never get
lesser,
back to that and thing. Lesser. And I think what Root is trying to say is, he's trying to watch the ball with that same ferocity that I do for the first ball of the year all the way through. And again, that's a really hard thing to train your brain on.
Yeah, 100%. And I think anyone desiring to play cricket at a professional level, like as a batter, if you want to get two things right, one is watching the ball from the bowler's hand and making sure you're in a good position, which is what he speaks in when we go into that, his part of that 1 minute clip, you'll see that getting into good positions early. And what are good positions? Right? Go into that next two sentences that he said, bro.
So the next one he says, and these are sort of linked to each other, but he says, what are your strengths and how often can you get to them?
Correct.
Right?
So
and I
understanding,
love this because...
It's about understanding your game, right? It's about knowing, based on your technique, the way you hold the bat, the way you're built physically, the way the positions you get into at the point of delivery, what are your strong shots and what are your weak shots? Because there's nothing called perfect technique in the world. Nobody can ever get perfect technique, right? You can get to the best within which biomechanically you hold the bat and you position yourself for each ball. Now, to understand your game within those parameters as a batter is very, very key. Now, how do you understand your game? What are your strongest shots? What are your weakest shots? Where are your weakest as far as based on your technique is concerned? If you have an understanding of that, and that requires like knowing your batting, right? And knowing how well you're going to score runs, or where you're going to score runs, and where are your strongest shots? If you get to know that and you develop your game around that, then you can figure, then you know, okay, this is where I score my runs and this is where are my least scoring runs, or these are where my weaknesses exist. So I know that once I know that where the ball pitches. So depending on where the ball pitches, what is it going to allow me to exploit, or what is it going to, what kind of place is it going to put me into where my weaknesses get exposed? Right. So with more repetitions, it gives you an understanding of when the ball pitches in these areas, I thrive. When the ball pitches in these areas, I survive. Right. Mm-hmm. And then it's about recognizing that and building your pattern of batting around those aspects. Right. And this is what great players do, or good players do. People who play at a professional level, they try to get to know their game as intimately as possible so that they know that it pitches in that area, there, runs. It pitches in this area, there, defense. I develop my solid game, my defensive game around my weak areas, and if I can improve on that, like if I can get a single off that, if I can get a double off that, right? And then so, okay, I'm okay with it. Sometimes it's an inside edge that, like while playing it, it's an inside edge that gives me two runs. So I'm not going to berate myself because of that inside edge. Because a lot of people pursuing excellence or perfection, they berate themselves when they get an inside edge off that area that exposes their weakness. So they're like, no. Like, I get two runs here. So I take that two runs and I take the imperfection with which those two runs come with, right? But
You're willing to say you have a weakness, right?
Correct.
And like, so I when I talk to a player who I know is, you know, very cerebral and things, I will bring up their weaknesses and they'll explain how they get around them. But if you do it to a player who's like, who's not in that kind of mindset, they're like, how dare you mention I have any weaknesses?
Exactly.
Like, everyone has a weakness, dude. Like, that's a normal thing to have. Right? And so it is that ability. And I think that's what's really fascinating about Joe Root is he's so close to being a perfect batter in many different ways. Right?
Yeah.
You know, like, he, no matter how you look at it, he's one of the, 10, 20 greatest players batters we've ever had in the sport. And yet his first go-to thing is, how do I limit the weaknesses that I have in my career? Right? Like, how do I do it? And it's funny because you and I speak to, especially over the last 5 or 10 years, for both of us, really, we've spoken to like a lot of billionaires, right? You speak to a lot of like highly successful people in other careers and everything. And I sent this video to Rob Barron as well. And he was just like, and this is one of the best sports cricket bettors in the world, right? And he's like, yeah, that's kind of what I do when I'm betting, right? Like, it's the same thing. Like, it makes sense. Once you can understand that, you have things that you can't do, how do you make sure that you limit the things that you can't do and make the most out of things you can do? And that's what everyone should be doing. This isn't just about batting.
I think high performers understand very deeply what their strengths are and minimize their margin of error to the best of their ability, right? Yep. And they stay patient. So they maximize their opportunities when they see it and they recognize it. It's like knowing, okay, this is that area where I'm going to score my runs from. And then they repeat that process day in and day out, day in and day out, day in and day out. Right? I get excited about this stuff because these are topics that excite me simply because this is the secret sauce, right? To life, this is the secret sauce. Right. And a lot of people are staring into the obvious and they're missing this,
Yeah. And it's a really hard thing to explain to someone who can't kind of make this is why I try and teach young writers. I was like, you're waiting for an editor to come in and edit your piece and make it good. Right. Whereas actually the secret sauce is working out what you can do and what you can't do and being able to look back at the piece and go, oh, okay, that's why that one didn't work. Right. So that it doesn't happen as much in the next time. And everyone else wants the external stuff. And it's like, what Joe Root has said is really good here, but there's no coach that can make you do that if you can't work out on your own. You and I have talked about this before. I worked with a player who had a massive weakness and then fixed it. Right. And then teams went back there and obviously his head had changed or his feet had changed and they're exploiting it again. And he went ballistic at me when I said there was a weakness.
I know you're talking about.
And then he came up. Yeah. And then he came up a couple of hours later and he said, you're right. Actually, I do. That it's fine if he goes ballistic because he's angry. He should be passionate about what he does. But it was the fact that he came back later and went, it is a weakness. You're right.
Very few people, Jad.
Show me what you can show.
Very few people are willing to speak the truth to people in an empathetic manner, right? Yeah. And I think they do a disservice to a lot of high-performing athletes in our fraternity by not speaking about these aspects, right? I think these are aspects that you owe to people that you cherish as cricketers, right? There are cricketers out there in Team India, in the periphery, that I desperately want them to thrive because when that talent thrives, that cricket's going to change for the better, right? People are going to see a different version of an exceptional talent that brings their own kind of flavor to cricket. And you want that flavor to excel, right? And I think it's about asking the right questions, right? A lot of times you can actually share something with someone, especially who's a high performer, through the medium of asking the right questions. And I don't think enough coaches actually do that, right? You can do it in a very non-intrusive manner where you're not telling them what to do, but you're asking them for insight, which pushes them to become introspective about their own game. And if you can do it from that perspective, you're actually doing it in a non-threatening point perspective. And you're actually doing it from getting them to think about their own game. When you can do that from a position of getting players, especially high performers, to think about their own game, then they are willing to have a conversation with you because it unravels more about themselves than proving a point or anything like that, right? And very few people actually do that. Very few people actually do.
No.
Like even the ball watching thing, right? When Joe Root is talking about, right? It forces you, like he talks about getting into good positions. It forces you to think about your own game to a point where, how can I get my game to a place where these two aspects, when unraveled and opened up, show me what I'm actually, what potential I actually have as a batter, right? That's why I disagree with a lot of what baseball stands for today. It's mindless cricket, to be very honest, beyond a point. Like, I understand the novelty of it to a certain degree. And that's where I think Travis Head kind of walks that fine line so brilliantly. Because I think just with the way he plays cricket right now, it tethers between the, like the line between madness and a plan.
Mm.
You know, he walks that line really finely. And he does it in his own way, which is what is so unique about him.
Well, so this is the last thing that Root says in that interview with Justin Langer. He says, make sure before each ball to get yourself into a position where you can score, limiting your risks. That exactly. is what baseball was supposed to be.
Be.
And unfortunately, what it turns into is this weird sort of cult of cricket, this cult of personality, this cult of alpha masculine thing, this moral crusade. But basically, what Root is saying there is what the best of what baseball was, right?
Yeah.
Which is, okay,
absolutely.
When Scott Boland was bowling to Australia and England, why didn't he have any success? It's because they wouldn't let him bowl his length.
Yeah.
Right? They wouldn't let him bowl his length, which meant that Scott Boland was no longer a threat to them in that Ashes, because that's all Scott Boland has, is that incredible length. Once you can take that away from him, that's really important, right? Go back and have a look at when they've been at their best. This is what they have done. But that doesn't mean you have to take the biggest risk in the world. All you're trying to do, and you're an expert on this, of, you know, as someone who walked down the crease, when you're coming down the crease, you're actually taking away some of your weaknesses at that point so that you can score the way that you want to score at that. So you're essentially doing the same thing. You're putting yourself in a position where you can score, and you're limiting some of the ways that you can be dismissed.
You're almost forcing the bowler to, you're actually preempting the game, right? By virtue of me walking down the wicket, I already know the two options that a bowler would go to or fall back on based on his own patterns against me, right? Like, when I walk down to an Andrew Simons and, say, pulled him for six or hit him down the ground for six, or a Mitchell Johnson, I knew more often than not the next ball could be were a slower short ball or a bumper.
Yep.
Right? The length ball was not going to come. So I just had to sit deep in my crease. And if it was a Yorker, which is the third option, I was already deep in the crease. I was putting myself in the best position to play that particular ball. But it's a short ball. I'm giving myself so much more time to see the ball come and weigh my options are all around the wicket, whether it's behind the wicket or in front of square. And like that is what baseball is supposed to be, right? But it's gone beyond that today. But again, what coming back to what Joe Root is saying, every ball is a batter. Anyone aspiring to play cricket professionally, every ball is a batter. If you can get yourself into the best position possible to play that ball well, what is the key here? To give yourself the best chance to play each ball well, your eyes, the level of your eyes need to be still at the point of delivery. So based on your own technique, if you can get into a position where your eyes are still in level, then you're giving yourself, and if your head, like from a technical standpoint, if your head can be over your front knee, where your head's here and your shoulders dipped a little bit, irrespective of where your hands are, none of that. If your head is over your front knee, you are giving yourself the best chance to play that ball to the best of your ability, irrespective of what your fucking technique is.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. I think Joe Root is very good at cricket, and that was a lot of fun. I want to talk about a topic that links to this.
Yes, I think I know what you're getting to.
Yeah, so that last comment about getting yourself into a position where you could score, limiting your risks, right? England, I'm going to call this, and I've just written it down because I might make a video on this later, but battle for the shoebox, right? Mm. So this Jason Gillespie keeps saying that Scott Boland bowls into a shoebox, right? And this is the big lie of cricket, by the way, that cricketers never admit. But basically, when it comes down to it, when you're playing a test match, you know the vast majority of the time exactly where each ball is going to come. right? Because most bowlers have a line or a length that is natural to them, and that is how they attack you.
Over depending on the version of the game. I think it's depending on the version.
Yeah, I'm talking about first class and test cricket,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you're playing Ravi Jadeja, no one, and you're a right-hander, you're not suddenly expecting him to bowl a foot outside off stump or back of a length, right? No. You're expecting him to bowl, trying to pitch it roughly on off or middle stump, straightening into your pads to be over and over again, yeah, on repeat, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're facing Scott Boland, you know he is going to bowl a bail length, right? Angle from outside off stump, coming back into the stumps, right? And then moving it in obviously both directions. Everyone knows this, right? And so let's go back to baseball again. The genius of baseball, and it wasn't just baseball who did this. The Pakistanis started doing this. The New Zealanders started doing this. They realized that because of the wobble ball, everyone was bowling the exact same length on repeat, right? And you couldn't play it. As you said before, it doesn't give you as many clues. So you're not sure what you're going to do. And so Daryl Mitchell starts batting a meter out of his crease, right? And Babar Azam starts batting a meter out of his crease. And England, through Joe Root, Ben Stokes, they start coming down the wicket so that you can't hit that length. And someone like Ollie Pope, who was a really struggling player, suddenly gets to the point where it's harder to bowl to him because two or three times and over, he's down the crease. Mm. So England's big thing is using the crease when they bat, right? And this is, if baseball has any lasting impact, and it's not like they invented it because Javed Meandab was doing it 1,000 years ago, but if baseball has any impact, it's using the crease better when you're batting, right? As a team, not just one smart player, but as a team.
Yeah.
Once Alex Carey comes up to the stumps to Scott Boland, we all should have just been like, this is over, right? Like, this is done, because they have been trapped ever since in that position where they can't change the lengths to any, they can't change it to Nisa, they can't change it to Boland, right? And they're just absolutely trapped in that position, which is what baseball was supposed to get them away from, right? And that is because of the skill of Alex Carey as a wicketkeeper to come up to the stumps and do that. And in a world of Robbie Utapas, who are all just batters who keep a little bit, to have a specialist wicketkeeper with that kind of skill who can come up to the stumps and do what he does at 136, 137, 138 kilometers an hour. And also Scott Boland, you'd be able to talk to
now
this.
Now suddenly 137, 138 isn't medium pace anymore. It's fast bowling.
Right. And it's also, but he's hitting the pitch, right? So it's a heavy ball as well when you're getting that. Michael Nisa is a little bit easier to keep to. Even though Nisa can bowl faster than Boland, it's a little bit skittier and you can get in the right position easier. But Boland hits the pitch and then deviates the ball. So my question to you is, Alex Carey said that it's a very hard thing to practice because it's not safe to come up to the stumps too fast.
It isn't safe.
You can't spend hours doing it in
there. It isn't safe.
How did Alex Carey get that good at this skill, which is a skill that had disappeared from cricket since the 90s?
It's a skill that he'd have to trust his keeping a lot with, right? And acknowledge that there are going to be times where it's not going to go his way and be comfortable with it. So he'd have to drop he'd have to increase his margin of error, at least in his mind, the acceptance of his margin of error. Because in general, life is about confidence, right? The more confident you are, the more successful you will be, or you'll give yourself the best chance to be successful. So you've got to make peace with the fact that it's not going to be all, you know, shiny roses all the time. It's gonna not go my way a few times. I'm gonna probably drop a couple of catches and be okay with it, right? Mm-hmm. But you're taking the chance to put your body on the line to be able to execute a skill that is extremely hard. Because Scott Boland, I can tell you from experience that he bowls 138, 140 clicks, and those are heavy deliveries. Like there's a lot of weight.
They hit the bat really hard.
The bat really, really hard. So the fact that he's exposed himself to that spot at the top, up to the stumps, takes a lot of courage, takes a lot of grit, a lot of determination. There's very few things from a preparation perspective that you can do as a keeper. The only thing you can do is try and do it to say a wobble board that they have that's used for slip catches and keep to that. So maybe that's something that was a part of his preparation. An interesting question to ever do if you can have him on comm box is to ask him what he did as far as preparations were concerned, as far as keeping up to a Scott Boland or a Nisa is concerned, right? And he'll probably share with us. And it'll be interesting that...
Did you keep up the stumps to people of that pace?
Yeah. They didn't like it. Fast bowlers don't like it at all.
That is also another part of this, that Scott Boland, because he's a low ego player, He's not worried about it at all, right?
No.
In his mind, he's like, fine. And that helps. Give me a bowler who you would have kept up the stumps to.
Vinay Kumar, S. Arvind, a lot of these guys, Irfan. Irfan, even now, sometimes when I'm playing Legends Cricket, I'm like, can I keep up? He'd be like, no, go back.
he would be a good one. So I think those guys are probably more skittier bowlers. They're more the Nisa kind of guys, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So it's that there is a kind of bowler where you can go up to stumps and be comfortable with. Not you're never happy because it is really, really tough. So I played indoor cricket, and because I have bad knees, I used to be the keeper because it's the best way not to hurt your knees.
Yeah.
And I would keep, and I played in London. When I came over to London, I played with a couple of guys who played proper cricket in South Africa, and they were big, tall, strong left arm bowlers. Yeah. And like, it's an indoor ball, so it's a tennis ball, so it's not going to hurt you. But you're sitting there going, I've only got a range of about 3 foot here. And if he bowls it anywhere outside of my range, I'm just going to have to turn around and pick it up off the net. Yeah. Because I don't have the skill or I can't move quick enough to be able to do it. And like, I mean, if you're doing that to a spinner, that's not how you keep up to the stumps to a spinner.
No, it's not. It's very different.
Stumps to a spinner, you're like, I can get to every ball.
Your reflexes have to be 2x faster when you're keeping up to a fast bowler, right? You have to, like, your instincts have to be absolutely on point. There are times that as a keeper, you have to just trust where your hands go based on what your eyes are capturing. So you've got to have a clear vision of the ball. You've got to see the ball as well as you can. And you've got to trust your skills a lot more to the point where you feel like you have to get up almost in anticipation before the ball hits the turf as to where the ball's going to go up to, and then trust that skill almost before it even actually happens, right? So you've got to, especially if you keep him to a left-hander, and because he's a left-hander, they're probably slightly easier for him. I found it a little uncomfortable when I have to keep to a left-hander to a fast bowler because I have to anticipate where the ball's going to probably end up and get my legs in position there. So I think two of the guys who did it exceptionally well was MS, did it really well. I think Ian Healy did it well when he did it against, say, when he did it to Craig McDermott, when he kept up to him sometimes. He did that to Glenn McGrath once, I remember, when someone is standing way out of the
mostly
streets.
When those guys were bowling slow balls, was the time. It was actually quite interesting that, like, a lot of Ian Harvey's success for Australia was having to keep up when up he played domestically, because he played with Ian Harvey. Played with two of the greatest wicketkeepers of all time, Darren Berry and Jack Russell, and they would be up the stumps.
Jack
and
Russell, Adam Gilchrist. Fuck.
Yeah, but they couldn't do it. But Gilchrist couldn't do it, right? So a lot of Ian Harvey's domestic success couldn't be replicated at the international level, right? Because Gilchrist didn't have that. Can I talk to you about a technical thing that I had seen, which I had never thought about before? If you could explain this to me, when he was keeping to the spinners, he usually has both of his feet square on. So let's say he's about, I don't know, what would you be, about 2 foot back from the stumps, 3 foot back from the stumps. Both of the toes are equally the same distance from the stumps, right? Mm. When he's doing it to the quicks, he's actually got an open stance like a batter. Yep. So his left foot is close to the stumps, but his right foot is actually like maybe a foot, even a foot and a half back. And I've never seen that before. Can you take
it's to accommodate for the give.
Do something?
Because you have lesser time to receive the ball.
Interesting.
So it's to accommodate the give. So if you're keeping to a right-hander, your left foot is closed, your right foot is slightly open, so that the ball's outside the off stump. So you're willing to bet on the fact that the bowler is going to be accurate here. And
because if he goes down leg, you're screwed.
You're screwed, right?
Anyway if you're up on the stumps, but doubly in that position.
Yeah. So you're just accommodating for the give of the ball so that you can receive the ball a lot more. That means you're giving yourself a better chance to catch the ball every time the ball, say, hits the outside edge. Because there's going to be a deviation, right? And you're training your mind and your body to not jerk when that edge happens. Your hands have to move smoothly, right? And so one way is to, you're kind of preempting the give or the receiving ability by opening up your legs so that your leg moves out of the way for your hands to come through and receive the ball. That's what he's doing.
It's fascinating. That was great. I really enjoyed that chat.
Yeah,
that was
fun.
Everyone's like, he's keeping great. And it's like, great. Well, let's talk about why and how and how, you know, and everything else. So that was fantastic. I've got a game show for you.
Oh my God. Okay.
And, I want you to blind rank your career. So I've come up with
why? Why?
Yeah, I know.
Why?
I've come up with what I believe, and remember, what I believe might not be what Robbie believes, but what I believe to be the 10 greatest innings in Robbie's career. 10 most important, 10 most impactful.
It's like I don't get trolled enough in the comment section already that you've decided to troll me on on live, buddy.
I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I troll you in literally every single episode that we have. people in the comments section are the ones who should stop trolling you. I should do it more. So I've gone through it and to have a look at what I think the best 10 innings are. So we're going to show the innings and they're going to come up on the screen in a minute. Can you see them? I can't see them. Oh, here we go.
Ah.
All right. So we're going to show the innings. There's IPL. And I don't have anything from, that's the only domestic cricket we have is IPL. Everything else is international cricket. And it's obviously ODIs and it's T20. It's all your career. It's the best of Robbie or the worst of Robbie. People can decide that.
Yeah.
But you then have to decide where each innings goes on a ranking from 1 to 10. And you have no idea what I've picked, right? And it might be, right, that I have completely done this in an order to ruin your life, or it might just be random. Right, it could be anything.
Definitely done it in order to ruin my life. Go for it.
I would never ever do that to you. But the first innings, you made 87 from 47 versus the Pune Super Giants. There's a callback in 2017. Where would you rank this innings, Robbie, in your greatest 10 innings you've ever played?
I'd say six.
Six. So that is 87 versus. Actually, I think what's his name will do it, won't he? Rakshit will do that for me. Okay, so
what's his name?
Anything? What's his name? The dude on the knobs. What do you remember about this innings? Anything special?
I remember that at the back end of the innings, I was like, I've never really played for 100, so like we were cruising and we were getting the score on a canter. So I was like, towards the end, I think we needed 12, 13 runs to win. And I was on 87. I was like, okay, let me see if I can try and get 100 here. That was the first and perhaps the only time that I was like, okay, I want to try and see if I can get 100 here. And got out trying to do that.
Who got you?
Can't remember. I think it was a fastball. I remember getting out in mid-off. I tried to hit the ball over mid-off and I got caught mid-off. Shanked
probably
it.
Using his feet as normal, coming down the wicket, trying to be a hero. All right, 83 from 51 balls versus RCB in 2014. Again for KKR. I've got the KKR jumper on today, by the way.
I know, I see that. There it is.
Oh, I can't even show the logo, wherever the logo is.
Yeah, we're going to get you some original stuff from the franchises, right? Like, we've got to stop buying all these things from hawkers.
I like hawkers. All right, 83 of 51. Where are you ranking this one?
This one is a good one, yeah. I remember RCB were on song that season and we were trying to, you know, get our way back into the tournament. So I would say four.
Four. Okay. That's quite high because these are IPL innings. We've got international cricket to come
on. I know.
Okay. 47 not out of 33 balls versus England at the Oval in 2007. Just before I moved to the UK, so I wasn't there. So I missed out on this one. Look at the young Robbie in the picture. My God, that looks like it's 40 years ago.
What the fuck? I look like that right now without the mustache.
I knew that would get you. Okay. This is an important one, right? For you?
Yeah. This is right up there for me. I'd say, this was also a little bit of a comeback game for me. You know, I was playing my first game after six games, and this is when I just kind of figured out my walking out. My walking down shot. So I would say between 3 and 2, man.
No. There is no between 3 and 2. There's 3 or 2.
Two.
Can I? This has nothing to do with everything you've just said. But can I just say, look at the lighting. There's something about English cricket games.
This is at the Oval when the lights are going down. Oh, bro, the lighting was just divine, man. I'm telling you, when you come below the equator, the lighting's just...
It's also like, England must be above the equator, mustn't they?
Above the
equator. Yeah. But what you get in England is you get the magic hour, right? Because it goes for longer.
Yeah.
So if you bat for a good period of time. Anyway, I don't know how we got that nerdy on this. 67 off 39 versus CSK again for KKR, again in 2014. You must have been good back then.
Yeah, must have been, eh? I would say 8.
8? Oh, okay. Nothing special that one, just a standard Robbie dominating.
No, so we were trying to build momentum in this tournament. I think we didn't win the game. So for me, if we don't win, then for me, what always meant a lot for me was, even if it was a 40 or a 30, did the contribution contribute? Did my score contribute to the win of a game? That's how I, like, for me, the measure of my success was, did it contribute to wins?
Can I ask you, we're 4 in. How's my choosing going so far?
Good. I'm worried for what's to come. This blind rating is scary.
All right. 88 off 50. Finally, we get a CSK one for the CSK fans against RCB. 2022. This is old man Robbie.
Yeah, old man Robbie. That was trying to keep my weight off stress, Robbie. You know, it wasn't.
I was going to say, you do look a little fuller. Little thicker there.
I was like, I'm telling you, like 2021, 22 were the most stressful years for me as far as staying healthy was concerned. Because I was still quick, but it was about looking fit. And I stressed a lot about looking fit, even though I was, you know.
Also, you got a really tall, good-looking man next to you, and you never want to stand next to him.
He's a good looker, that boy, Shivam Dubey.
Yeah, he's good looking. Like, also, he's got a presence, right? I remember standing next to him in an airport once going, I didn't realize you were this presency and this big. Yeah. Like, he's got good posture.
He's got good posture. He's slow as fuck, though, but he's got good posture.
Yeah, cannot move. His feet are made of concrete. Absolutely. Yeah. You're talking about you being overweight. You could still lap him.
I really wish someone like him spent some time doing plyometrics, at least trying to be quicker, you know? If he just shifted his thinking, shifted his training regime a bit. I remember sharing that with him when I played with him, but he's gotten slightly better to his credit, but still can be much faster. I don't know if he's got the...
Great.
This one, I would say... did I do 5 yet? Have I done 5 yet?
This is you have not done 5.
I've done 6, haven't I?
You've got 1 at 2, 1 at 4, 1 at 6, 1 at 8.
I'd say 7.
You've only done even numbers.
I'd say 5.
Okay, perfect. All right. Again in 2022, we've got 80 off 58. Wait a minute. How can they both be in 2022?
Yeah, that has to be against KKR.
I don't know which one this is. This is 80 off 58. When did you make it?
Yeah, you've got this wrong. You've just fucked with my head, by the way. Should I keep my eyes closed? Because it showed me what's to come.
Yeah, sorry. 80 of 58. When was this from? Do you know?
I can't remember, bro. This must have been from 2014. 80 of 58 versus CSK. Not from 2022. Because I wasn't playing for KKR in 2022. Yeah. 80 of 52, 58 versus CSK.
This was 2015. Sorry, 2015. We got the wrong year there.
Yeah,
my fault.
2015. Yeah. 2015.
Who are you batting with there? Is that Dre Ross?
That's Dre. This was at CSK where he came and smashed it. Like literally at the back end of the innings, I just fed him strike because he was smoking the ball, bro. So I was like, again, a chance for me to get 100, but I was like, no, fuck it. Like, let's get him strike to smoke as much as he can. And he did. We ended up getting 212, I think. 212 or 220.
Big score for 2015,
like. Yeah, big score for 2015. And we won that game. I remember it was one of our rare wins against CSK in CSK. At Shea Park. I would say...
Where are you ranking this one?
I've done 2, 4, 6, and 8 already.
You've done 2, 4, 5, 6, and 8.
Bro, man. These are all good stuff. 7.
7. Okay.
Throw bad innings in there, bro. So I can...
86 off 96 at Indoor in 2006. Again against England.
My debut.
I should say this. Your debut. A lot of people I know in England... they really remember you as someone who screwed over England multiple times. Where are you going? This has got to be an emotionally important game, right?
Yeah, it was. This one, close to my heart, because I would say that the call-up came when I least expected it, and I was in the worst form, buddy. I can't tell you. It felt like I was literally, when I got selected, the 2 days before that, I was playing a corporate game for Air India. I was playing for Air India back then, in corporate cricket. And I was thinking, shit, I'm batting really badly. I probably need to take a break from the game for like a month or two. It was literally what I was thinking. And I get the call-up. I'm like, what the fuck do I do now? And then I remember going for the nets, and I had this back and across initial movement. And because growing up, my self-awareness wasn't very high. And so my self-awareness, even with my batting, wasn't very high. I went through more form and rhythm, right? And I think the initial moment started off as small. And as I kept batting well and scoring runs, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, so the bigger it got, the more out of position I got into. And then the weight transferred off. And then to compensate, my leg went across and then would get out LBW. And then I got to this game. I remember a day before the match, I was doing this initial movement, 2 days before the match, I was doing this initial movement, and then Greg saw me struggling and he saw that I wasn't hitting the ball well, Greg Chappell, and he just called me up and he said, you know what, are you open to just try something else? I said, sure, because I would give anything a shot right now. And he said to me, to his credit, he said to me, why don't you just stand where you are and just watch the ball, and when he bowls, just play without an initial movement, just watch the ball and play.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I'll try it. But he said, when you're watching it, expect the full toss ball, like a low full toss. He said, the fastest ball a bowler can bowl to you is a low full toss.
Yeah.
The second fastest is a Yorker. The third is an over pitch ball. The fourth, slightly shorter than that. The fifth is a good length. And the slowest ball a bowler will bowl to you will be the bouncer. He said, if you can bat with that mindset and just watch the ball, you're giving yourself the best chance to play the ball well. Mm. And so I did that. Like this innings, if you go back and look at the highlights, no initial movement. Just watch the ball, saw it and played it. Saw it and played it.
Who were the bowlers? Do you remember?
Jimmy Anderson, Sajid, what's his name? Sajid Khan? Sajid
Mahmood.
Sajid Mahmood. Stuart Broad.
It was Liam Plunkett.
Liam Plunkett, I think, was also debuting in this game, if I'm not wrong.
It was Liam Plunkett. And the other seamer was Kabir Ali. Do you want to know what Jimmy Anderson's figures were?
I remember hitting him out of the ground for six. The pull should be bowled.
8.1 overs, none for 67.
Yeah. And he bowled with a newie to me, yeah? It was a young Jimmy Anderson.
He was a good white ball bowler, though, especially in those days, because he swung it so far. But yeah. Give me a lot of. I love the stories. I'm glad. I wanted this to be about you reminiscing, but I can't help but notice you just haven't come up with an answer yet.
It's hard to give up and give an answer to this, man. I've given up like five, six, seven. I've given up. Four. I've given up. Three.
You've got one available and nine. You've basically taken all the middle grounds, right?
I've just fucked myself over with this blind rating, haven't I?
Oh no, you got number three. You got number three as well.
Do I have number three?
So you got number one, number three, number nine, and number 10. All you've got is extremes, Dev.
I'd have to give this a three.
Three? I would have thought so. I thought that made sense. All right, the third best innings you've ever played, 86 from 96 on debut. What a way to start. 50 versus 39 versus Pakistan in the 2007 T20 World Cup group stage.
Number one.
Number one. I was hoping this would be number one as well. Take me
to
that.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
It was my first game, not my first game, but it was obviously my T20 I debut. And there's so many stories attached to this, right? Because, and also it meant so much more to me, because after I finished playing cricket, I didn't know about this at the time when I retired from cricket. The day I retired from cricket, from Indian cricket or international cricket, was the day I made my debut. It's the same day. I didn't know till about 2 months after the fact. It was September sometime, 14th of September, I think, if I'm not wrong.
But you mean the actual date? You mean the date?
The actual date, yeah. The actual date.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the actual date was the day this match happened. And when I went in a bat, we were when I went, Gauthi got out very early. That's when I went into bat. And then Virubhai got out. And then Dinesh Karthik got out. And then UV came, UV got out. And we were like 20 for 4 in 5 overs or something like that. And then Mahi and I had to stitch up a partnership. And then we did that. We took the team to about, I think, 90 odd or so when I got out. And then the rain came on. And then we stopped play at Durban. And then we went off the field. And we came back on. And then the only guy I was finding it really difficult to kind of line up or get my setup right against was Sohail Tanvir. Because of the way he was bowling, he bowled like almost wrong-footed. It felt like wrong-footed, but he was still fine.
It's such a weird action.
Very weird action. So it's very hard. Like, you almost have to get ready before he jumps. Because that jump itself is like quick, right? So I figured out how to play him much later in my career. And then we stopped playing them. So the Legends cricket is when I kind of figured out, okay, I know how to get ready to him now. And then I got out first ball after we came back after lunch. It was just after my 50. But that 50 came under very crucial, at a very crucial time. The team was in dire straits at that point in time. And it set the team up to finish off well, which Mahi and Irfan and the and Harbhajan and all that did for us. And that the outcome of the game, it just brought us so much momentum, man. It just set the whole World Cup for us. That last ball run out of Misbah when Srishant is bowling. I just watched the highlight or a reel of that on Instagram of Srishant, you know, just before he ran into bowl and then Misbah stopped him, backed away, took his helmet off and then came back on thinking that he's going to get him to think a lot more, which is a clever thing to do for a batter. But Srishant, you could see the fire in his fucking eyes, man. You knew that he was very clear what he was going to bowl. And he bowled around the wicket like a good short ball just on the off stump. He tried to pull it. He rushed him into that shot. That was back in the day when Durban was still quick. It was one of the fastest wickets in the world, right? And then he was late on the short ball. The ball went straight to UV. UV, you know, ran towards the stump and then saw Srishant and I were waiting at the stumps. Srishant took the ball, got him run out. And then we knew what was to come. It was the bowl out, right? Pakistan are like, okay, maybe it's a tie. And for us, it was about not losing the game to Pakistan in the World Cup because India hadn't lost a game to Pakistan in the World Cup up until that point, right? And in the 2007 World Cup, in the Cricket World Cup in West Indies, we hadn't played Pakistan because they weren't in our group. And everyone thought we'd play them in the second stage. So there was a lot of pressure on us. It was a really young side as well. One of the things that weighed on us, beside it being our debut games for 95% of the team, was that you're playing Pakistan and you've not lost to Pakistan in a World Cup for forever, right? And so we didn't want to mess up that stat. So there was a lot of pressure and a lot of things running on that game. So that's why that and then the bowl out also happened. So it just kind of was a cherry on top of everything. So it just means
what
so
is
much.
Better, the 50 of 39 or the bowl out?
The 50 of 39. The bowl out was just the cherry on top.
So where are we putting the 50 of 39?
Number one.
Easy. Can I just say also, just on that, that lineup that you went up against was Muhammad Asif, Umar Gol, Yasser Arafat, Sohail Tanvir, and Shahid Afridi.
You know, when Mahi just came into bat,
that was a goated bowling lineup in T20 cricket.
Yeah, and when Mahi came into bat, I think 5 or 10 runs into our partnership, Umar Gol bowls a short ball to me, and I'm standing outside the crease to negate the swing, right? Because he's swinging the ball as well as he's bowling quick. And he was bowling 145, 150 clicks. He bowled a short ball and I tried to pull the ball, hit me straight in my solar plexus. And you can't and you don't want to show the Pakistanis that you've gotten it, right? And when you get hit in the solar plexus with the cricket ball, you can't breathe. Like, it blows the fucking wind out of you, right? And I was like, I looked straight in his eyes, knowing fully well that I can't breathe. He broke eye contact. I turned around and started coughing just to catch breath. You know, it's like, like you do that and like, just to kind of, and to be able to breathe again, you want to empty your lungs as quickly. That was
all right.
Like on a lot of levels, something that I will always remember. Many parts of that game.
You have the first 8 spots taken now. So, what am I going to bring up now?
Don't even want to know.
59 versus Australia in ODI in Mumbai.
Fuck, this is such a weird inning. Oh, fuck.
Oh. Isn't it weird that I kept a couple of the good ones for the end?
Yeah, you're an asshole. That's why. this one, bro, I have no option but to put it at 9 or 10, right? As in, it's one of those. But again, this, again, you know this game in the Wankhede, the old Wankhede Stadium? Oh, bro, that was a... It was like a coliseum, man, with the noise, with the sound, the atmosphere. It was like roaring sound. And it's like every shot off the bat reverberated off the stadium back into the ground. So if you middled a ball, it's like, pow, just, it came back at you. It's just like divine to play cricket in. And I remember we were struggling in this game. I can't remember what the score was, but I came in the bat number 3, I think, if I'm not wrong. And then wickets just kept tumbling around me. And I remember I was batting with Bajupa at a point. And then that's when I was like, we just need to get 187. We were 60 or 70, I think, at that point. I was like, I'm just going to go and attack here. And I think I even forced Gilly to come up and keep to me because I was walking out to every bowler. Like, I hit them over mid-off for 6. I think it was James Hopes who was bowling pretty heavily at that point in time. And I was like, I walked out to him, Nathan Bracken, Hilfenhaus, and then...
No, it was... I can tell you the bowling lineup. It was Brett Lee, Mitchell Johnson, Nathan Bracken, James Hopes, Brad Hogg, and also Michael Clark bowled a little bit. Good. James Hopes, 5 overs, 1 for 13
And I hit him for a 6, I remember, because he was hitting the right length, and I'm like, got to get this guy out of that length, right?
He did go for a 6, I'll give you that.
Yeah, over mid-off, I think, I remember. I took Hoggy for some runs. I had to kind of farm the strike a little bit, which is why I kind of played 59 balls. But I also saw wickets falling around me, so I had to slow down. I eventually got out to Michael Clark.
I didn't even notice that.
LBW to Michael Clark. I was like, ah. Those are the days when you play those defensive front foot, like the front foot defensive shot of the bat and pad with together. Because you thought the ball had spun. Michael Clark never fucking spun the ball, and he was a
never.
Yeah, he was a, unless you played on the ranked turner. Like he was like Jadeja.
Unless he played on that. Do you remember when he took like the
6?
Yeah, when he took all his wickets. The only time he ever got the ball off the straight. Yeah. But do you know what's better? You didn't just go out to Michael Clark. You went out to Michael Clark defending.
Yeah,
which I think
worst
is the most
thing ever.
Disgusting way to go out to Michael Clark.
But we ended up winning the game because Zach, after I got out. Zach and Murali Karthik took us over the line because they played with aggression as well. And then we ended up winning the game. It was so cool. It's hard, but because I defended him, got out defending the ball, I'll put this at number 10, unfortunately.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
Number 10. Oh, wow.
I know you've
got... I thought that was one that might go a little bit higher. But okay, number 10. That means you only have one spot left, number 9.
Yeah, I have to try and get ahead of you, don't I? I don't know what you got. You dog! I should have seen this coming. For fuck's sake! Jared!
I was so worried that like
why
you wouldn't leave me.
Why did I see this fucking coming?
I was so worried that you would work it out, and I was like, and when you took all the top 8 spots, I was like, oh no, it's going to go last where it's supposed to go. That's going to be the worst thing I've done. And instead, it has to go at number 9. The 9th best innings of Robbie Utapa, ranked by himself. Everyone ranked by himself. Is his 3 from 4 versus Bermuda? Did you even make 3 from 4? Is that what it was?
I thought
you faced more balls in that one. Oh my god! Rakshit saying he hit it in the intro.
Rakshit, but thanks, dude. Like at the final hurdle, you get me. You get me again, Mister.
So, take us through this. What happened? Because you're a young player, it's an important World Cup. You know, there's a lot going on. You're one of the next big things. You're this attacking player, and then you get an edge. And any new ball player could get an edge, right? When it hits the bat, do you track it with your eyes, thinking there's no way he's going to catch that, or What happens? Take me through it step by step.
I can actually think back to the energy that I had in that game. I think before this game, we played Bangladesh and we had lost to them. And I'd gotten out early in that game as well. And so, you've got to understand who I had around me as a 21-year-old kid. I had Virender Sehwag, I had Saurav Ganguly, Rahul Dravid, and Sachin Tendulkar, right? And they made me open the batting. So when you knew that the best opening batter at that point in time was Sachin Tendulkar, right? If anything, I should have been batting at number 4 or number 5 or 6 even, right? But for whatever reason, they had as in Craig Chappell had Sachin bat at number 4. I think Dada was at number 3 and I had opened the batting. So I was like just a bunch of nerves in this game, right? I cannot tell you how nervy I was. I knew that this is the game I had to score runs, right? And I had to score some runs and to, you know, kind of keep, more than keep my spot, but just kind of justify my spot, right? And do justice to the fact that I've gotten this opportunity to actually open the batting for India in a World Cup. And I remember going in a bat feeling so nervous versus I was watching the energy of every other batter in the team where they're like, we're going to score runs today. Let's try and score as many as possible. I just didn't operate from that energy at all. Like there was nothing in me at that point that made me feel like, I was like, let me just first get my first 10, 15 runs, you know? I was feeling nervy. My hands are sweaty. I sweat a lot. My hands were sweaty, clammy hands. Body wasn't feeling like I had flow. Just an absolute nervous wreck chair. And then you won't believe it. As soon as even the 3 or 4 runs that I got were edgy, didn't feel right, right? And just wasn't able to shake the nerves off. You generally, when you're feeling nervy, you shake the nerves off after your first couple of runs. And I couldn't shake the nerves off. I promise you, as soon as I edged the ball, just the energy I possessed, I think added to the energy that Dwayne actually had when he went for that catch. Because it felt like, as soon as I edged, like, oh shit. You know, that's how I felt. Mm. And here you saw this big, burly guy throw himself to the right and that ball stuck in his hand. And I was...
Do you remember, like, because you would have seen this a million times.
I was stunned, bro.
Now, right?
Like, despite the energy.
Because sometimes you get caught at slip and you don't move your head around quick enough to see it, right?
No,
you get caught at slip and you have your head there.
Bro, it's gone. Like, as soon as Israel looked, there, because, like, oh shit. It's like, you know, that nervy oh shit? It's not like that, like, you reclusive oh shit. It's like, oh shit. And, like, he was in the air. I was like, even today, I can't articulate the emotions that went through me when that happened. I'm able to laugh at it, but I can't, like, I genuinely can't get my head around those bunch of emotions that I felt that day.
It's incredible.
And I watched our team score 400 runs.
Well, I was going to take you to the next step of this. So the guy that got you out, do you remember the bowler's name?
He was making his debut. I don't remember his name.
His name was Malachi Jones. Okay. Malachi In that Jones. Game, he bowled 7 overs and he went for 74 runs. Right. In his career, Robbie, he played 12 ODIs and his bowling average was 60. Like, it's remembered for Dwayne Levarock's great catch and everything else, but it's also just as unlikely that Malachi Jones took a wicket. He was an all-rounder. Like, he wasn't like a frontline bowler.
And he was not like, quick. He was like, and I hated medium pacers because they were fucking ginger. You know, there are guys like got to, I'm like, well, like if I had known how to walk out to these guys at that point, I would have walked out, right? Because they're too slow. Because after I developed my walking shot, anyone who was just ginger, right? The first thing I did is just walk out to them. I would create pace on the ball by
like
shortening
Ben Stokes
the
and Josh
length
Butler
of the
do that as well, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've seen them do it against media paces for the same reason. They
for me,
don't like
I felt
for the
stepping
ball.
Out was uncomfortable, like would keep my, like I wouldn't, it would jar my vision. So I felt walking out kept my eyes a lot more stable. So walking out felt a lot
Can I just point something out here? Mm. That the 10th best innings according to you, that you ever played was against Brett Lee.
I can
Mitchell
do
Johnson,
nothing but laugh.
Nathan
but this
Bracken,
is this is the whole
and the
point.
Ninth
of...
best innings is Malachi Jones and Dwayne Leverett.
Like, you know what? This is anyway what blind what is it rating is about. You got to muck it up at some point.
100%, 100%. Yeah. And obviously I set that up so that you would fail. But thank you very much for playing along. I thought that would be fun, but I didn't know how much fun it would be.
It was fun.
And I certainly had a lot of fun. We got a bunch of super chats. Let's roll through them very quickly as we finish up the day. Naveen says, what's the mental toll on someone like Rutu? He's been consistent domestic performer, just scored 100 in the last match, yet no selection. How does that a player process that?
Naveen, that's a great question. Buddy, it's very hard to process. You have to make it make sense, right? And it takes a toll and you need to almost kind of find silver linings to kind of lean back on in these circumstances. It's not the easiest thing to do. It is hectic. And you have to find a way to see silver linings. One of the challenges with Indian cricket is that you're constantly operating on survival mode. And to switch from that mindset takes immense amount of resilience, immense amount of self-talk and positive self-talk. And you have to be able to be a silver linings guy. And you have to find a way to keep fighting, especially if you don't come from one of the three big states in Indian cricket, which is Mumbai, Delhi and Punjab. If you're not from one of those states, then you have to keep pushing yourself.
Bart says, Kiri O'Keefe from Com said that England bowlers struggled against left-handers. Are there any hacks to adjust lines and lengths in game quickly when bowling to a mix of right and left-handers? Or is this more about nets and pre-game? I think this is something that the next generation of cricketers won't have because we'll have so much data on them. We'll be able to say to them, you struggle with this. The problem is at the moment that you generally only find out that you have a problem against left-handers when you get to international cricket or you get to like top-level franchise cricket. And so realistically, there's no reason why Josh Tung shouldn't be. I'm not just signaling him, but specifically he's the one with the really high average against lefties and the really low one against right-handers. He should be able to work through this. And I've had to work through bowlers before, but I think that's the advantage in the next generation of cricket is once they get to 21, 22, some coach is going to take them aside and go, the analyst just told me that you're doing this. Let's look at new plans for left-handers.
Yeah.
On the left-hand, right-hand thing, it does put you off the same as tall and short does and everything.
It's about a mindset shift also, right? I think it's like the hack to it is you practice as much as to bowling to left-handers as much as you practice the right-handers. There are generally more right-handers in the world than left-handers.
Yeah.
So that also makes it one of the reasons why bowlers bowl a lot more in the nets in practice to right-handers than to left-handers. But if you do want to be good at bowling both the right and left-handers, then you've got to practice for it in the nets. Or even in your just general angles, right? You bowl, like say for example, you're bowling just to a wicketkeeper, you're bowling just to hit the good areas. You practice six, like you bowl an over to the right-hander, then you bowl an over to the left-hander. And then you understand the mindset shift and the biomechanical shift that you make while bowling in those angles. So then when you do bowl up against a left-hander, then you make the adjustment in your mindset and the biomechanics to be able to hit those channels. The best bowlers in the world still have it. Yesterday, Andrik Nokia got someone out, LBW, got someone out yesterday, got Esterhuizen out yesterday in a game after Esterhuizen got a 50. Next ball was to Sherifane Rutherford. First ball, bowled on his leg. He bowled the same right-hander's channel to a left-hander, got clipped away for four in the first ball. It happens to the best of bowlers, but it's that presence of mind to make the shift at the top of the mark.
Foxer1 wants to know, if you could come back reborn as a cricketer, is it Wasim Akram or Viv Richards or someone else?
Any day. I love Wasim Akram, Sir Vivian Richards. Any day. He is one of my greatest inspirations in cricket. When I walk in a bat in a Legends game, I chew a gum and I try and imitate the swagger that Sir Viv had, because he is my biggest inspiration in cricket. I love him. When I met him, the first thing I said to him is, Sir, you are my biggest inspiration. Even today, I try and be like you when I go out to bat, because I don't think anyone in the world possesses the kind of energy and the aura that he possessed when he walked into a ground. Like, bro, he'd wake up from his sleep and walk into a bat in a test match with a swagger like he was already batting on 185, man, and you couldn't fuck with him. Oh, what? That was... he is... I love him.
I would want to be, wasn't that Graham or Keith Miller? I would want to be someone who bowls really, really fast and slugs, because that's awesome. Foxer One says, mustache CSI, SCG edition, Boone and Head in a crime-solving show. Yeah, I've got a very funny story about this. There used to be a show called The First 48 Hours, which there would be a murder in America, and then they showed you the detectives following it for the first 48 hours, right? Yeah. And it was my drinking show. Right. And we would have a drinking competition. And every time a mustache came on the screen, you had to take a drink. And if there were double mustaches, you had to down your drink. You have no idea, Robbie. You can only watch like one.
Listen, this has to be one of our shows.
You can only watch
on
one episode before you just, you're unconscious drunk because everyone, the cadavers have mustaches.
Bro,
right?
This is it. Everyone. Let's do a watch along. Let's do a watch along on Combox. Okay. With every time someone hits a four or a dot ball or whatever, we can come up with a parameter, we take a shot. It won't last 20 hours, brother.
We've got Pradeep here. I don't know if there's another message, but maybe... Wait. Sorry,
let's go.
Bring it back up. I didn't type... is it just me or do Aussie batters look ugly? Head, Warner, Marsh, Smith, always frustrated me seeing them. Are Australian batters ugly, Robbie?
Are they? Mark Waugh was a looker, bro.
Damien Martin.
Oh my God. I'm so glad he's out of an Indian coma right now. So like, I was literally talking about him on the Royal Show and I was like, I really want to know what he's up to. And then suddenly 2 days later you hear that. I'm like, oh my God, like, I hope he's okay.
You know the great Damien Martin story, isn't it? Before Trump becomes president the first time, he was following like 27 people on Twitter and one of them was Damien Martin.
What?
Don't get me wrong. Like, it's the one thing that I wish, if I'd still been working like at Crick Info and had the unlimited budgets of when I started, I would have literally tried to track this down. Like, because it is the absolutely craziest thing of all time that Donald Trump was following Damien Martin. On
we'll Twitter. Get there soon. We'll get there soon. We'll
I do think that Australia, I think in Australia, I remember playing in a game once with a guy who was really, really good. He was a low-level county player and we played together in England. And he played and missed a ball and the wicketkeeper fumbled it. And I ran through for a single and he was like still practicing his technique to try and get the technique right for the next ball. And it was a cricket writers game and a bunch of cricket writers were there. And they were all like, that is the epitome of Australian cricket compared to England cricket. Whereas like you were just like scampering through trying to make it work in every way possible. While the England player is like, how do I perfect my technique for the next delivery? And there is an element of I was never really told about technique as Australia. I was always told, this is how you make runs. This is what you need to do to make runs. And I have noticed, like even in my local clubs, how many kids have these perfect techniques, but they have no idea how to score. And in Australia, it was the opposite. It's like, how do you score? And if you're not scoring, can we fix the technique on the back end of it? So I do think there is a difference between the two ways that the countries think about batting.
Yeah, but what does that have to do with good-looking batters? Or ugly batters.
No, because he was trying to perfect his batting technique and make sure he was I missed this ball because I didn't have my elbow up high enough. Whereas that would never have occurred to me. I would have just been like, I missed this ball, can I get a run?
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like it's just a different outlook the way we have. It's very rare that I play a bad shot and spend the next 2 minutes trying to fix my technique. If I play a bad shot,
I misunderstood that question. It's so funny.
Are you still thinking about head soft balls?
Oh, no, don't even. That's not even good.
Vaishak says, as an Indian, who would you fear more, Peak Smith or Root? I like that.
Both are exceptionally good. I would actually fear both of them, to be honest, because I think when they are in form, they are dangerous, man. You can't get them out. Steve Smith doesn't look like he's getting out anytime soon.
I think with Smith, if the problem with Smith is he's probably going to make 600 or 700 runs in that series. Mm. And I think with Root, he'll make 100 or 200 and then he's a bit more like Sachin. He doesn't have the big series that define him in the way
that
even Alistair
Cook can. I think in that sense, I tend to agree with you because Steve Smith can be a real thorn in your flesh. But I think someone like Root gets creative after a certain point because he's also he's got so much more, his technique allows so much more options in his game.
But says, as a fellow Bangalorean, do you call yourselves Bangalorians?
Bangalorians.
The Mandalorian.
Bangalorians, yeah.
We call ourselves Melburnians as well. I've always thought that was wrong. Curious about KA cricket has evolved through different eras, 70s, 80s, 90s, 10s. Is there a common systemic ethos or was it more about the players?
I think in the 70s and 90s, I think just the talent was so rich. And I genuinely believe, Bart, that, you know, the wickets produce these cricketers, right? Like every, like I think any good batting team is developed by the pace battery that they have in their side. If you're facing high quality bowlers in your nets, automatically you have to become good batters. Because the pace battery, when we in the 10s had, and the pace battery in the 90s that we had, and the spin bowling that we had, which was India was more proficient, like India was more known for its spin bowling. So in the 70s and the early 80s, the spin bowling Karnataka had, and E.A.S. Prasanna, Chandrasekhar, Raghuram Bhat, all of these guys made us the best players of spin. That's why we had the likes of a G.R. Vishwanath, back then Brijesh Patel, Sanjay Desai, and all these guys from that era, right, who did really well exceptionally. And then in the fast bowling, you know, pace battery that we had in the late 80s, early 90s, Chabagal Srinath, Venkatesh Prasad, Dodda Ganesh, David Johnson, you know, I'm missing a few here, but they were like Mansoor Ali Khan, all of these guys, really, really, really good fast bowlers and swing bowlers that developed the likes of Sujit Somsundar, Rahul Dravid, you know, who else was there in that era? I'm missing people there. K. Jeshwant, who was captain when Karnataka won Ranji Trophy, who's like a mentor to me. You know, all of these guys came up from playing that high quality bowling. Come to our era, Vinay Kumar, S. Arvind, Abhimanyu Mithun, Stuart Binney, all of these guys, right? I missed Roger Binney in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s. But all of these guys, they really developed our batting a lot. Playing against them in the nets is what developed our batting. Developed the likes of Karun Nair, KL Rahul, Manish Pandey, myself, and just gave us good. And then so the quality of bowling that we faced in domestic cricket was seldom better than the quality of these guys. Right? Because they were so good. So I think the bowling really develops the batting, and that's what brings a team forward in domestic cricket.
Fascinating. Max says, Smith's 500 since the board of Gavaskar. Is he back? Is Steve Smith back?
Robert, yeah, I think so. That. I think so. Like if you look at Steve Smith, if you observed Steve Smith through the ashes, he has been very happy to fly under the radar. Obviously, there's been a lot of learnings for him since the whole Sandgate episode. And I think, you know, we saw Smith, an uninvolved, you know, I would say batter, not batter, but uninvolved personality at the highest kind of, heights of his batting, right? But here we're finding a super evolved Smith personality with someone who deeply understands his batting as well today. Like today, he's a savant at batting. I would literally say, like today, he literally wants everything to be absolutely pristine for each delivery because he respects each delivery so much. That's why he annoys the crap out of bowlers and umpires and oppositions with everything having to be perfect because that is the extent of respect that he has for each ball, for his own wicket, right? Literally a savant. And that is why I think he's well and truly back.
I think he was 98 out of 100 in his peak. He's probably not 98 out of 100 at the moment. He's probably like 95 right now. Mm. And he'll probably never get back to the peak that we saw before, but he's so close to it. Mm. Andy says, I've loved the Indian team for 30 years, but it's impossible to support them now as just a political tool. Pity since the white ball team kicks ass.
Well, we live in a different world, Andy. To be very honest, it's a political world. The general demeanor of the world today we exist in is deeply political.
Can I just say this as well? I don't know how many people know this, but like, I'm pretty sure there was an element of political interference between England and Indian cricket in the 1950s, I want to say, when it comes to the Commonwealth and what was happening with India and everything else. Like politics and cricket have always been so incredibly intertwined. Mm. And in some countries they've moved away at times, but have a look what happens when you see something, whether it be Sandpaper Gate, which Robbie said before, it only takes like the slightest thing for politics to get back involved with cricket. Yeah. And a lot of times we just keep our head down and we pretend it's not happening, but it's definitely happening at the moment. Jack says, can any player replicate Cummins 12 of 68 versus Afghanistan in a similar circumstance? Anyone from the past or present who you could count on to do what he did? Matthew Hoggard, Ishant Sharma, Jason Gillespie.
Ali, what's
they
that,
all could have played that innings.
What's that left-hander, yeah, that for England when he batted with Stokes? This left-arm spinner.
Leach.
Leach.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. I think a lot of those guys are set up for those kinds of innings, yeah, right? Yeah. Like the incredible thing about Cummins is he had to become that player on that day, which is very, very different.
Astronaut says, Robbie, have you identified any new player in SA20?
I have. What is his name? Is this young 18-year-old fast bowler who I absolutely love, man.
Ashutosh says, I think Cricket Australia and New Zealand should merge BBL and Super Smash. They're not going to merge those two, but there has been an offer to New Zealand to bring in a Big Bash team, but they're not going to share in the spoils, I believe, of the Big Bash League. And that's why the New Zealanders are a little bit upset with that at the moment. But yeah, it's not just this league. There are so many leagues in the world that don't need to exist. Like, you don't need a BPL, a Sri Lankan league, and a Pakistani league. It would be much better if they all got together. But the truth is that these boards don't really work well together. Who is the new player you found, Robbie?
Mokoena, the left-hand, the right-hand, right-hand fast bowler. Nkoma Mokoena, I think his name is. He is superb. For me, when I look at him, he's a youngster. I absolutely love. He bowls about 140, 142 clicks. He's just 18 years old. Very, very raw. Plays for Pal Royals. He's gotten wickets in the last couple of games that he's bowled. And when I look at him, when I look at his eyes, I feel like I'm looking at a very young Rabada, right? I really like him, Mokoena. He's good. He's quick. 140. I think as he gets older, he'll get a little bit more quicker as well and get stronger. Him. There is Jordan Harmon. Oh my God, bro. He is so good. I don't know how he's not playing for South Africa. He is really, really, really good. He is easily, I think, one of the best fielders in South Africa today, hands down. Him and Bretzke, easily one of the best fielders, both of them, best fielders in South Africa, hands down. You can't get a two off Jordan Harmon in T20 cricket. Like in the outfield, you cannot get two off him. He is rapid. He is quick. He's got a brother, Ruben, who plays for, older brother, I think, Ruben, who plays for Pal Royals, who's also good, but not in great form. But Jordan is hitting the ball really well, plays for Sunrisers, very, very good. I really enjoy the way he plays cricket. And he's a good-looking lad as well. He'll be great for South African cricket, I think. He's 24.
What was the secret to your rejuvenation in 2021, asked Andy?
Just a better setup for me, Andy. I think I thrive in a setup where there's give and take between the player and the franchise. And for me, I really think that the way CSK, KKR, they operate as a franchise, there's a lot of give and take. They give a lot to the players. They do a lot for the players. CSK overextends on the way it gives to its players. It makes you feel indebted towards the franchise, which really sets up any experienced player or any player to feel like, hey, what can I do for this franchise? Like, I really want to do well for this franchise. So I think that's what kind of brought that back for me.
Is AB the best all-format batter ever? Andy asks.
All-format batter? No. Virat. Virat for me.
No, Viv Richards. How could you not?
All-format, bro. Like again, you've got to go era by era. Like, for me, if you ask me...
I would go Viv, Sachin, AB.
Yeah, I'm talking about this era. Like all format is because I'm including T20 also into this. Because
I would still have AB. I would have AB ahead of Virat still.
Would you? For me, I would put Virat ahead of AB. In all three formats.
That's all we have for Kimapa today. Huge show. And where we found out that the ninth greatest innings that Robbie had ever played was a 3-off-4 versus Bermuda. but thank you very much to everyone, especially all of those in the comments. Sorry about the technical issues that we had. But, you know, once you get past an hour and a half, it's a marathon.
Anything can happen.
Remember, please subscribe to Combox and subscribe to me and Robbie everywhere you can find us. And we'll be back soon for more of Making Fun of Robbie.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes.
Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.